Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 71 of Season 7 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Aaron Neuwirth from Out Now with Aaron and Abe. Welcome back to the show, Aaron.
Thanks for having me, and hello. I'm very excited to talk about this movie.
I'm glad you are. That's you know, I think myself and anyone who's listening, you know, wants people who are gonna be here who are excited to talk about the movie. You know, we don't want someone coming on saying, well, you know, I'm not really. I actually did have one guest earlier this season who isn't a fan of this movie, but he thought we were talking about a different movie. So
that's what I'm saying. I'm here now, and I'm telling you right now, this podcast is about to get 5% better because of my involvement. That's what I'm telling you. I'm guaranteeing this.
Only 5% better?
I'm underselling it. I'm underselling it because I want you to just feel how enthusiastic I'm gonna be as we get into this more. But for the time being, just know that there will be a improvement. And it's only going to get better. That's where we're at.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Just try to keep that those mushy parts of the brain off your face.
Simon says we'll see.
There you go. All right, that's fair. That is a fair way to do that. All right, so minute 71 begins with John reacting to brain matter. And ends with John realizing that the whole plan was really just a fake out. So we ended things on Friday with John in the iconic elevator scene, which I'm so shocked. And I didn't realize this when I was doing my original research the entire elevator scene the entire action of the elevator scene all takes place within 1 minute. You know, on Friday we went deep into that about how the whole thing works because it just happens so fast and it's great.
It's a tense and packed sequence as far as what it's accomplishing, but yeah, it doesn't take very long to transpire. And between that and a boat scene later, I feel like those are the two most like graphic scenes of this movie.
I think that's fair to say. True. Yeah, for sure. It might even be. Do you think it's the part of the most graphic scenes in the entire series?
I was thinking about that. In terms of like amount that you see this elevator shootout, probably is pretty good because like two has like the icicle in the face. I mean that's not excessively gory, but it's also an icicle in the face, so it's like, you know, it's not nothing.
Icicle in the eye.
Yeah. And then one has like Takagi getting shot in the head. I mean, that's pretty brutal. And like makes you think about it for a minute. You know, this is more, these are the latest guys that die, where that guy's like, that's a key character shot by the main villain of the film. So, I mean, but in terms of just like viscera on display, yeah, no, I could argue, there's an argument to be made that this is like probably the biggest one.
Because I mean, the other two movies that come after this are much tamer. You know, they wanted to make them more family friendly. I don't know why, but whatever.
Well, you say that, but I mean, the next one's PG-13, but the fifth one, which is a movie that they filmed for some reason, that is rated R. It's just not a
Die Hard movie.
It's hard to remember like what actually transpires in that film. I know there's, I mean, it's mainly for language because it's just John yelling at random Russians, telling them that he's on vacation.
That's true.
But yeah, this is probably the hardest of R's in like the parabola of Die Hard.
So. Right. Okay. That makes sense. So, I mean, basically we only get a fraction of a second at the beginning of this minute, but it just shows all of the blood and brains on John's face after him, shooting Otto. The fight between him and Otto is just a great standoff. It's, I mean, I would actually argue that that's something that Tarantino could have come up with the way that he does that. I don't know if you want to call it a Mexican standoff or a Russian standoff or whatever it's called, but it's just done really well. And, you know, we get that fraction of a second here just to remind us of what we saw on Friday. you know, with all the blood on John's face, which you got to give a lot of credit to the makeup and special effects guys for actually trying to get that right. You know, to make it mm-hmm. really look realistic with the way that they do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's yes, it looks appropriately grisly and a kind of situation where it's like, oh boy, at least somebody survived out of that thing. But not even a but is like a bad, but as far as the attention paid to the kind of the emotion of that scene, on the one hand, it's like John's just getting out of this. And he's like, he kind of like, he's like kicking his way out of the elevator. He's like, oh boy, that sucked. But then like the set, you know, after, and then he, you know, he'll encounter Zeus and he'll get his, he'll gather himself, he'll collect himself. He's like, that's just Zeus. That's not some other guy I got to shoot again. But the second Zeus asks him, like, you know, are you okay and all that? He's like, oh yeah, it's not my blood. He kind of just like exactly. walks it off. It's like, we're done with the emotion that comes with shooting four men in an elevator. And now we're back to, yeah, I'm fine. It happens.
Right. Exactly. I mean, we discussed this a little bit on Friday, but do you think that part of the issue with Otto was a revenge issue, knowing that something has happened to Ricky, even though he doesn't know for sure. He just knows that that's Ricky's badge.
Do you think he was like taking that into account in the shooting?
Yeah.
Not necessarily. I think it's too quick for him to really, I mean, for one thing, he doesn't really know what happened beyond he has his badge. Well, and we'll see in preceding scenes that he'll find out what happened.
Right. Exactly. But the idea that, you know, Gunther, basically Otto shot Gunther. Okay. Who John was holding off. And then, you know, John didn't necessarily have to shoot Otto at that point. I mean, I don't have a problem with him doing it. You know, don't misread that. Don't misinterpret what I'm saying there. I'm aware of the fact that he was meant to, but he waits a fraction of a second and then just decides to shoot him.
I'd argue,
you know, again, he doesn't have another option here.
I hear you. I'd argue he's being a cop first. I mean, as far as John McClane, he has certainly killed plenty of people in his day. That's John McClane. At the same time, he is also a cop and a good cop for that matter. He's not dirty. He's not corrupt.
That's what my captain keeps telling me. Right.
Yeah. Well, he's not. Yeah. I mean, he's not dirty. He's not corrupt. He, you know, having marital issues and, you know, been borderline alcoholic. That's a different story. But in terms of him doing the work to solve a case, I mean, that is what he's essentially trying to keep intact to some degree. As far as how I'm seeing this scene, where he's in a heightened situation where he's probably going to have to kill people, as he's done many times in the past. And yet. He's still like, he needs to know what's happening. He needs to know what Simon is, what he's all about, where he's going, what he's doing. If there's a way for him to disarm the situation, that's going to be his first instinct before inevitably having to shoot a man in the face or else he gets shot in the face. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I don't think there's a part of him in that specific moment that's like, I'm going to shoot you in the head now because you did something to my friend. I think he's just reacting to the moment.
Okay.
Using his cop instincts.
Right. Okay. Again, that I think that's completely fair by going that way. So basically, you know, we see John just for a fraction of a second, and then we're in the dark area of the subway where Zeus is now walking down, you know, the bridge layer that we had talked about a few weeks ago, looking around, and it's pretty funny that Zeus just starts going, "Hello, anybody down here?" Like, you know, who's he expecting to find there? You know, obviously the place is deserted, but he seems to think that things are a lot safer than it probably is.
Yeah, he's being a little naive. I mean, I think he's just caught up in the moment, if you want to argue it that way, as far as I'm just, the adrenaline's going. I'm just kind of like, I assume John's down here somewhere. Let me just bounce into this room and see what's going on.
No, I don't think, you think Zeus thinks that John's down there? I don't think so.
What else is he expecting to see down there?
Well, he saw at the end of last week, I'm pretty sure, or maybe it was on Wednesday, he saw like five construction guys leaving that area. And that's where he went over there to go check it out. You know, I don't think that, you know, I don't even know if he makes the connection to the fact that this is more or less the basement of where John went in.
No, that's I'm fair. Not sure. I'm thinking of the... I'm trying to think of the scene without watching the scene. No, that makes sense to me. That's fine.
Right.
As far as not expecting necessarily John to come out of there. But in terms of Right. In terms of like just like holding on to the, you know, I'm on this mission. I'm pointing myself in a certain direction. I'm kind of throwing a bit of caution to the wind. I just saw some cops that, you know, confused me somewhat. But like, so let me investigate this further. That's where my head's at. I'm not being as mindful of my surroundings as I might normally be, as Zeus, the man who's very skeptical of everything.
Correct. Completely. So, you know, then the shot changes and we see John scurrying, you know, on his back outside of the elevator, which, you know, he's got his gun pointed at these four dead bodies as he tries to get out, which I don't think I touched upon this the other day, but John happens to be a great shot that he was able to kill both Carl and Kurt with one shot each. You know, he's a pretty good gunslinger from that perspective.
He's Roy Rogers, right?
He's
a cowboy.
That's true. That's very true.
When push comes to shove, the white hat's going to do what he can.
Correct. Yeah, he shot both of them in the stomach and killed them right away. So that's pretty impressive. I mean, Kurt is this giant. I mean, what is he? I think we talked about the fact that he was like 6'10". You know, he's like this humongous guy.
Yeah, he's a big guy. Yeah.
And John takes him out with one bullet. It's the short guy that he had trouble taking out. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe because he's less of a target or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, as John scurries out of the way, he like lifts himself up. He sees that they're dead. And then, you know, we're back with, you know, he's in the tunnel and he hears someone coming. He doesn't know it's Zeus. We see that it's Zeus. And then he screams, "Put your hands up. Put your hands up now." And Zeus raises his hands and goes, no, John, no, God, it's me. And then John goes, "Jesus Christ, you almost gave me a heart attack." Which is pretty funny. I mean, he just dealt with four guys in an elevator. And, you know, this is what's going to give him a heart attack, that there's one guy walking around the area.
I mean, you know, you got to have a scenario like that. There's no time to suffer more fools.
That's right. It's true. And then, you know, as they get closer, Zeus looks at him and goes, "Are you all right?" And John goes, "Huh?" He goes,
It's not my blood.
not my blood. And he goes, "What the hell's going on down here?" And then he points him to the elevator and goes, "Go take a look in there." You know, he's basically saying, "All right, go take a look at this. Look what I just had to deal with. Look at those four dead bodies in there. You know, and this isn't my blood, so don't worry about it." It's very interesting the way that they do this. And then what's great is you look at John's face and you can see that John is starting to put the pieces together here.
Yeah.
You know, he's looking around and he's going, "Wait a second." And so, you know, there's a whole bunch of different phrases that you can use for it. You know, the penny drops, the ball drops, the other shoe drops, you know, that type of thing, of the whole idea. So I actually looked up these phrases to see, you know, what their origins are, stuff like that. They all pretty much mean the same thing, but I was wondering where they come from, stuff like that. So I'm assuming you've heard the phrase, you know, the penny drop, right?
Sure.
Okay. So it means that, you know, someone suddenly understands or realizes something, right? But when I did a search for penny drop, so it actually gave me something from Mythbusters.
Okay.
You have any clue what they might have tested dealing with a penny drop on Mythbusters?
Probability about the heads coming up?
No, the idea that, you know, if you drop a penny off a skyscraper, it will
that have will kill somebody.
To kill somebody or embed itself into the sidewalk, right? So they had an episode where they actually tested this. And what they did was, here, I'm just going to read a quick synopsis here. It says, firing a penny at terminal velocity, 65 miles per hour, which is 105 kilometers an hour, into concrete and asphalt discs and a ballistics gel head with a human skull failed to result in any penetrations, likely because the speed is too low and a penny's mass is too small. Even when fired from a rifle, the penny was unable to penetrate concrete or a ballistic gel dummy skull. Even modifying a rifle to shoot a penny at supersonic speeds failed to cause any type of penetration. In comparison, a real 6.5 millimeter bullet split the dummy skull. Visiting the Empire State Building, the likely source of the myth, Adam and Jamie, realized that updrafts and roofs of lower floors would prevent a thrown penny from actually even reaching the street down below.
Easily. Yeah.
Which I found really interesting because, again, I grew up always thinking about the fact that if you went up to the top of the Empire State Building and throw off a penny, you're going to kill somebody. But it's nice to know that that's actually not going to happen.
I'm not going to call myself a science nerd or, you know, someone that understands all the physics all the time, but the wind resistance alone, given the mass of a penny, just immediately dispels that in my mind as far as putting it into a situation. Okay. Like,
that's
like
fair.
Put into like a vacuum or something, even then, as was proven, even at increased speeds directly throwing down, it's like, it's still a penny. Like, it's not, it's just not, it doesn't have like the capacity to do too much harm in a that kind of scenario. But I, you know,
okay, makes sense.
I'm happy to humor it.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. Now, there's the phrase waiting for the other shoe to drop. Do you have any clue where that has come from?
Where it's come from? No.
And what it means? Like, no.
What it means is like, it's yeah. Like, there's a kind of there's an eventual realization that's going to take place. Just waiting for that to occur to some other party.
Correct. Right. They usually say it's to await a seemingly inevitable event, especially one that's not desirable.
Exactly.
Okay. But then the question is, okay, where does that come from? And so apparently it has a very interesting etymology. The idea is that people used to live in tenement apartments, you know, in the late 19th and early 20th century. And the apartments were built with similar designs. And you had the bedrooms located directly above and underneath one another. So it was normal for someone to hear their neighbor removing their shoes in the apartment above. And after one shoe made the sound of hitting the floor, the expectation for the other shoe to make a similar just noise was created. Right. So so it basically became shorthand for the idea of waiting for something that you knew was going to happen to actually happen. So you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. So I find that really interesting. I never even thought about that whole idea. You know, that it comes from something real, you know, that someone just taking off their shoes.
I mean, yeah, there's always some kind of dumb definition when it comes to like that kind of, that's such a specific phrase, waiting for the other shoe to drop. I figure there's some kind of like, you know, homegrown story that's very literal.
Okay. Makes sense. So, you know, Zeus then comes back from the elevator and he screams, "Hey, McLean," he goes, "where the hell is everybody?" And at this time, did you notice what John is doing?
Is he taking off his shirt and cleaning his face from the blood?
Yes, he took off his shirt, and you know that he had this shirt billowing with him because you know it's not a Die Hard movie without John walking around in a wife beater
in his tank top. You know. His iconic McLean look. Yes,
that's right.
Which, right. So which technically is only iconic because of the first movie, because the second movie, it's cold and he's wearing a parka the whole time. So he changes outfits, but he's still in the cold for the movie. He's wearing some form of jacket for the majority of Die Hard 2.
Okay, right. That's true.
What, one is the only one where it's like, where he, you know, it's shirt, no shirt, tank top, white tank top, gray tank top, then no tank top at all.
That's right. Exactly. It's the evolution of John McClane shirts. You know.
Always the famous, you know, it's the tank top completely changes color during the course of that film, which is always
fun. Yeah, of course. Well, it makes sense because he did crawl through
it's that you know that every inch of it gets covered in soot, so he changes color.
Yeah, why not? You know that in the Nakatomi Plaza, they just you know they wanted to save money and not have the cleaners have to go get rid of all the soot from the air conditioning ducts. Who knows?
Here he just gets progressively bloodier, and sometimes it's his own blood, sometimes it's not. What I especially like is John. I mean, for being like, you know, out with Bonnie Bedelia and on a hangover, coming off a hangover and everything, he still looks really good in this movie. Like, he looks fit, you know, he looks like he's ready to action. Like, he for Bruce Willis in 95, coming, you know, 8 years after, 7 years after Die Hard at this point, it's like, he looks really good in this movie, if not somewhat better. Like, he just looks
great. Because he was constantly doing these type of movies, you know, during those 7 years.
Yeah, so he's staying in shape for sure.
Exactly. And,
you know, I as much as I'm qualified to talk about handsome men of the late 80s and 90s. It's like, you know, I think his scruffier look in the 80s, as far as his, you know, having longer hair or whatnot goes, here he's like, it's right before he's embracing baldness, like completely. So he still has like some hair going. He looks good, you know, he's doing the job.
Yeah, sure. And so he basically, you know, takes his shirt and he finds this a water leak somewhere and rinses out the shirt in order to wash off the blood on his face. And then he's just like walking around, looking around. And then they give us a great camera shot where it zooms in on him as you see that he has this like look of exasperation and terror on his face. And then we see that he runs up and sees, you know, Ricky's body, which is still hanging upside down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way it's like he's just discarded is just really,
that's right.
It's upsetting, honestly. It's sad. Yes. Like, you know, something I so love about Die Hard with Vengeance is the fact that the New York PD, like, there's a lot of life in those actors. There's very specific choices made to, like, how to cast them and everything, where you don't necessarily need, a trained theater actor to play Cobb. Or having Colleen Camp around, like, you don't need these people necessarily, but because the 90s had better ideas as far as how to cast the background and make it look more authentic, you make these choices. And so we spent enough time with Ricky to like get an idea of his personality and everything, and so by the time we're like, you know, seeing the result of it, it's like, oh, that sucks. Like, it's sad that he's, you know, we went from this guy who's, you know, having, given the situation, a fun enough presence, to being just casually discarded, like, you know, wet laundry. And it's,
yeah,
you know, it's annoying. It's bad.
It's true. And I love how John even has any doubt as to, he has doubt as to whether he's alive or dead, and goes and checks to see if there's a pulse. You know, even though when you see a body lying like this, the odds are, you know, but again, it's his friend, so he's still going to want to check it out. And then he sits down next to the body as Zeus comes up to him. You know, at this is the point where Zeus then says, "Hey, McClane, where the hell is everybody?" And John's response is, "Simon says."
Yeah.
As he begins to start realizing what's going on here. And that's how this minute ends. Did you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
Not specifically. My main note was the tank top look. That's what I wrote in my notes in big bold letters. Tank top look.
Okay, that makes sense. That's what it is. That is the John McClane tank top look. All right. So the script. So the script there isn't that much for this minute, but I'll still read through it. So it says, the Wall Street subway station platform. Zeus walks down the ramp into the subway platform. Simon's abandoned skid steers are still sitting there. Zeus jumps onto the track and follows the line of abandoned equipment towards the drilling hole. The Federal Reserve corridor leading to the vault. McClane comes from the corridor with extreme vigilance, training his gun left and right. He passes the monitoring room. The two federal marshals are dead in their chairs. McClane comes to the vault. The doors open. The other federal marshals are unconscious on the ground. McClane moves vigilantly inside. McClane enters the vault. He looks at the drilled hole in the wall. He hears something coming through the hole. "Don't move!" Zeus emerges, throwing up his hands. "It's me!" McClane relieves, lowers his gun. Zeus moves into the vault. They look around, stupefied. All the gold is gone. McClane, stunned. That mother... It was all a setup. And that's how they get that here in the script. So it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I like the way they did in the movie, obviously. But in the movie, they make it seem as if, you know, the elevator vault opens up to right to the point where Zeus comes down into the... You know, into the subway area, which to me seems a little too convenient.
I mean,
I know why, like, they do it. I'm not saying I'm not saying that I don't understand why. I know why they're doing it, but still.
Yeah, but it's not also. It's not like it's like a well. You know, here's the doorway to get to this place. It's a hole in the ground. I mean, it's he's getting into
a specific area. But that hole in the ground takes him exactly to where John is. That's my point.
Well, but that's. But the hole is there to begin with, right? Because that was the plan, like, to have the ease of access in these specific areas so they can get these things.
Yeah, but the bomb didn't go off where they wanted it to go off.
Are we sure about that?
John threw the bomb outside of the train.
I mean,
they wanted it to go off a little bit further down on the line.
If you want to say a little bit further, I mean, we could negotiate how much little bit really means and how much that would apply to where exactly this hole would be. I mean, it feels like the plan went off pretty much as expected for them.
Well, they were planning on killing everybody on the train.
And regardless. The bomb was still going to go off maybe 50 meters ahead of where it went off.
But I think it would have been even a bigger explosion if the subway train exploded also.
I don't think so. It's not gas-powered.
I don't know. I would think that it would do more damage.
I don't think so. Neither
of us are bomb experts. So,
listen, I've taken my share of classes on New York metros and pyrotechnics. I think I have a little idea.
Hey, all right. So, Aaron, it's all yours. Please give us your opinion on this.
I understand the point you're trying to make. I do think if we put even if the hole where the bomb has created is somewhat to the left of where they might have preferred it, it's still going to be in the general vicinity where you're going to walk down a hole and there's inevitably going to be that elevator and this gold and that. Like, it's just a matter of which direction that hole might be facing.
Okay, but according to the script, which makes sense, you know, they have to walk, Deuce has to walk through the hole that was drilled in order to get to where John is. But well, here...
They drilled a hole.
That's right. But we don't see him go through any hole. We see him come down into this large area, and it just happens to be the same area where John is already. That's what I'm trying to say here.
I hear you. It's also, it's just a giant hole. So it's hard for me to think, like, if the bomb went off 50 meters this way, suddenly the hole, the enormity of the hole, like, makes a dramatic difference as far as where someone walks down and sees something.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. That's fair. That's fair. All right. So every Monday we have a segment called the McTiernan Monday, where my guests will give their top five John McTiernan directed films. So, Aaron, why don't you start off with your number five and work your way up?
All right. Well, I've seen all of John McTiernan's films fairly recently, actually. All 11 of them. I caught up with the ones I hadn't seen before. The easy thing about this list is that he has five good films. So it was not hard.
Pretty much. I have two that I haven't seen. I still haven't seen Nomads, and I don't think I've seen Rollerball. Those are the two that I haven't seen. 13th Warrior was horrendous. I just saw it recently.
The further you can stay away from Rollerball, the better. The same applies for Medicine Man. Oh, good Lord. And I am not a big fan of Last Action Hero. I admire what it's aiming for more than how it's executed. So with that in mind, my number five is The Thomas Crown Affair, which I think is just a really solid heist romance. It just does the job. Number four is The Hunt for Red October. Probably the best Jack Ryan movie. Certainly the most watchable. It's one I can easily put on and just enjoy. Die Hard of Vengeance is number three. Which rules. These next three are all favorite movies of mine in general. Predator is number two. What else can I say about Predator? It's a spectacular film, top to bottom. It's a perfect, like, what if a slasher, but with a bunch of 80s giants?
That's right.
And they still die. So there you go. And then number one is Die Hard, just a perfect action film that we've already talked about before on this podcast. Yeah. So
yes. Yes, a few seasons ago, but yeah, sure. All right. Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Aaron. Why don't you tell people where they can find you?
I am available in a number of places. Everything I do can be found at my personal Substack page, thecodazeek.substack.com. I host the podcast Out Now with Aaron and Abe. My friend Abe and I talk about the weekly movie releases. I am the editor-in-chief at We Live Entertainment, so all my movie reviews can be found there. I write Blu-ray and Criterion reviews over at whysoblue.com, and I'm on all the socials at Aaron's PS4.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, moveyourobminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to moveyourobminute@moveyourob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay, mother.
Johnny comes marching home again. Hoorah, hoorah. We'll give him. them a hearty welcome then. Hoorah! Hoorah! The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.